To so many people, you know, lifelong Cubs fans, it's our happy place. It doesn't feel like a year without going to Wrigley Field, and you guys are amazing at what you do.
And that's the thing, is that the Wrigley employees are always so helpful. They go beyond.
When you see the same faces year after year after year in the same sections, it makes you feel, it all feels like family. That you're going to a place like it's a little family reunion.
Every family member and friend who comes to that I take to a Cubs game or I take on a Wrigley Field tour, because there's nothing better to do than to be in Chicago, and you all made that possible.
Like I said, these are not just employees, in my opinion. They're like family.
I've brought people from all over the world, all over the country, people that don't like baseball, they love Wrigley Field. And we have you guys to thank for that.
Welcome to Mistaken Identity Beyond the Ballpark. We explore the fascinating personal lives of the people inside Chicago's most iconic sports venue, Wrigley Field. Our podcast will take you on an amazing journey, introducing you to some incredible people that we've met along the way. We'll discuss hot topics, play a few games, and just try to have an overall good time. There'll be plenty of surprises along the way, so stick with us to see where our journey heads next. But for now, kick back, relax, and enjoy the latest episode of Mistaken Identity Beyond the Ballpark.
All right, welcome back to us, Mistaken Identity Beyond the Ballpark. This interview, by the way, this is season three. I've been trying to get this guy on here since season one, and he is finally here. Kyle, the busiest man in the world, thank you for finally joining me.
I do what I can when I can.
Now, for everybody to know out there, let everybody know how busy you are as a dad and a teacher. Let them know how busy you are these days.
Well, you know, the juggling many plates, it's what I do. So outside of teaching, you know, obviously we've got Wrigley, and then being a dad, two children, I got an 11-year-old and a 4-year-old, rotating schedules. And then if I can add in any side hustles into that, because those kids apparently like to eat and be fed. I don't understand it myself. You know, I'm all about fend for yourself, but apparently they don't agree with that philosophy.
Now, a lot of our staff are watching this. Most of our staff watch the podcast. You all are going to get to see today. Kyle is probably one of the funniest supervisors we have at Wrigley. You're probably going to know that today. But I want to talk about this magic you do. Where did this whole magic thing come from that you do? Where did that come from?
So when I was a kid, I was one of those very awkward, shy, let's just say larger children out there. So I had to find some sort of niche that got me more out there and outgoing to talk with other kids, because my mom and dad didn't want me to just stay at home and to try to just be left by myself. So magic kind of just found its way in there. I ended up with my grandpa going to a candy shop when I was a kid, and right next door to it was a magic shop. And then from there, the love kind of just fell. I started seeing some sleight of hand material, a little card trick that the shop owner did for me just kind of set it off. And my joy in life comes from kids. I love seeing kids smile, seeing kids happy, seeing kids laugh. So being able to take that and then use my little magic tricks around the ballpark, it's one of my favorite things to do in the summertime. You know, you can turn somebody's day around just by giving them something different that they're not used to, adding a little bit of magic in their day or something that is the unknown or the unexpected. It makes me happy. I like to see other people happy, especially kids.
Now, people that are watching this on Patreon, they see a classroom in the background, and they're probably curious, like, are you doing this during class time?
So, thankfully, I was able to finish my early meetings today in the morning time, so I currently have the next 45 minutes free. So, this is during my lunch period, and then after this, I have what's called a prep period. If you're not used to teaching, that's when you usually have meetings. There's recurring time. I'm department chair for social studies at our school. So I would be doing curricular planning, having the other teachers come to me or I go to their classroom so I can plan out their lessons in advance. We can figure out what they're going to be covering in the next couple of weeks as the year's ending. But I did all of my work early today, hence the bags under my eyes, which is why I can have this time to talk with you, Frank, because we keep having to postpone it, which is crazy. Yes.
Now, you're a teacher, one of many at Wrigley Field, and And those of us that are not teachers, supervisors, you know, we in April and May, we hate you all because, you know, you are gone and we're doing all the work. But tell me how you got into the teaching field, why you wanted to be a teacher, and what it's like being a teacher nowadays in 2023.
Well, it didn't start that way. You know, like, why would I want to be a teacher in 2023? It's because I know it's my career, it's my profession. But I've been working with youth ever since I was in school. I love tutoring my friends, helping them out when I was all the way back in middle school, high school. I used to do study groups in high school where I would actually go to the elementary schools around us and I would help out some of the sixth graders, seventh graders, work on some of their math skills, their language skills, their reading skills. And then I would do youth programs because I was very heavily involved with my church. So we would do youth groups and we would do, again, like mentorships with younger kids. But my plan was originally first to become a pastor. So I was actually thinking about going the religious route. And then when I got into college, I was also contemplating going into law. I actually went all the way through getting my LSAT scores and possibly going into that route as well, because I love legality. I love looking into legalese, current things that are legislatively set, more so for like my protective Papa Bear mindset. I'd like to get more involved with, you know, helping out community efforts for people that are underprivileged, or if they, you know, are set up in systems that are set up to push them down or dissuade against what their rights are. I'm fiercely protective against that, especially with how I grew up and the friends that I grew up with. But I got asked by a friend of mine my junior year of college if I would be willing to help her in her classroom out in the Pilsen. And I was like, you know, sure, whatever. I can, you know, find a couple of hours in my day to go and do that. And ended up staying with her the entire week. From there, I just had this deep, absolute love of being in the classroom working with kids, not something that I had ever really contemplating doing. And from helping her just that one week, thankfully, I was able to add education as a second major and still finish graduating in 4 years. And then I ended up going straight into teaching right after that.
So talk about kids real quick now. Because I had asked your advice on, I forgot what it was, but I asked your advice last year about something with Jordan. And people that are watching this are probably wondering, what does Kyle know about raising a black boy? Why are you asking Kyle about Jordan? But let's fill everybody in. You have kids, and how is it like being a dad? And tell them why Frank would possibly come to you for advice on a black kid.
You mean talking to me, a depiction of mayonnaise incarnate? Why would I know anything about black children in America? So I say that with a very light heart. So my entire life, I have thankfully been growing and raised in a community that has had a lot of different races involved. It's been very culturally diverse my entire life and upbringing, which I have to give total thanks and kudos to my parents for making sure that I was in settings like that. My best friends growing up were all within that. And then naturally, growing up in a very diverse environment, my love interests started to spark in the same way. And I ended up meeting my wife, who I currently work with, and she is a mixed race woman. She is half Mexican, half black. So I myself have two biracial children. So that is kind of where my understanding of how to handle children of color work, outside of also working with kids the last 10 years, teaching them in diverse settings. I teach in the south side of Evanston, so near Howard Street. So if you know anything about the demographics of Chicago, it's a very black majority community in this area. And our school is actually very racially integrated, with being mostly one third black, one third white, one third Hispanic. We do have an APIDA population with Asian Pacific Islander, Desi Americans. So kids coming in from the Middle East or coming in from Asianic countries. But there's a lot of kids from different backgrounds that work here. Now, in raising my own kids, though, the thing that's been very cognizant in my mind the entire time is I grew up with white privileges left and right. I mean, the color of my skin has been basically a bulletproof vest for the majority of my life, because even in hard situations, or even near the South Side where I spent a lot of my youth going into different communities, I always knew that I was going to be protected, or I was going to have advantages outside of that because of how I was raised. And again, major thanks to my parents for making me aware of that, but not using it and abusing it, but utilizing my white privilege more as a shield for, again, the people within my life that I love and care for. And then using that to also try to use my voice, which I know is going to be heard, to speak up for communities that are marginalized, that don't get the same opportunities. And my two children are not going to have those same opportunities either, because I have two beautiful brown children. They're being raised in a society that has systemically created institutions against them, and they're going to have things that are setting them back or bringing them behind. And they're not going to have the privileges that their dad had. So I can do everything I can to hopefully change that system to make it more equitable for them getting older. So when we had our conversation about Jordan, and when we were talking about, you know, just kids in general, it's because I want to make sure that the children that we love, that I would give my life for, have an opportunity at least getting close to the privileges that I had growing up. They're not going to have the exact same ones, but it'd be great if we can start shifting to a system that would make that equitable for all kids. I know, crazy concept to actually let a human being be treated like a human being instead of bucketing them in these different arenas and then setting the system up against them. But, you know, I'm crazy. What can I say?
But as a teacher, you know, in the news you hear about school banning books now from kids to read. They don't want them to read certain things, or changing history, or transgender or drag queens and be around kids. Just, as a teacher, I'm just curious. Growing up now, I feel like we're going back in the day, but and just coming up now. But as a teacher, as you're seeing all this on TV, what's going through your mind? I'm just curious.
I'm seeing, so I teach social studies, so history is a part of what I teach to my kids, and history is doomed to repeat itself often when we do not learn from the mistakes of the past. Right now, we're seeing cycle after cycle after cycle of repeated animosity and hatred against marginalized groups because we have a system of otherism. If I can put all of the blame on this other group, I, within my power structure that I've created, can set it up so that I can hold on to the power that I have, and the rest of the population around me have to suffer the consequences of that. That's exactly what's happening across most of these states that are pushing through with these book banning initiatives, and they're setting up legislation against doing, you know, a multi-perspective or a diverse curriculum, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, DEI initiatives within these states that are being thwarted or knocked down. I know Florida just passed basically, it's a probation against the African or the Black studies curriculum in a lot of their high school or collegiate classes. And the AP board down there has had to kind of bend to the will of the current governor about his beliefs on that fight against quote unquote wokeism. Now, without getting too political there, taking all politics out of it, no matter what your political background is, if we are trying to systemically create a system that silences the voices of others, we are only setting ourselves up to not just repeat the past and the mistakes of the past, but we are undereducating our youth so that they're not going to come into a world to know how to better navigate that, the struggles, the difficulties, the opportunities, and succeed on them. We are only hurting them. To take away literature from kids, to take away certain books or perspective books from kids because it talks about things that you personally are uncomfortable with, or maybe you don't know a lot about. I argue, why not read the book yourself? Take a chance to actually look into this literature yourself. We live in a system of representation where our lawmakers, our representatives in government, they, in popular sovereignty, this idea that we have an exchange of power. We as voters vote them in. We give them some of the power that we retain as citizens because all power rests in the hands of the citizens. And then they make decisions on our behalf. But I think we're also moving into a system where now the people that are elected in feel like they are the power holders, solely speaking, and they get to decide what's best for all without listening to their constituents. That's a dangerous system that we're living in, because when you do that, book banning is turning into a big power play because it becomes an issue of otherism, putting off the issues there. It's like in my magic, doing sleight of hand. I'm going to distract you here so I can really do this over here. That's what's happening, but it's happening with the lives of our kids. It's happening within the lives of our students. That's not okay. We can't let that passively happen. We need to remind our government officials they work for us. We are the bosses. They are solely doing what should be the will of the people. If the will of the people in that area are pushing for those initiatives, in my personal perspective, I am against that because I believe that we need to be hearing more voices. That means then the citizens and areas around there, they should hopefully be bridging communities and going into those areas and then speaking about that philosophy of acceptance and love and inclusion and then preaching that, coming in from a good faith perspective, and then changing the minds of the people in those areas and the hearts of those people. That's how we can then start reflecting that on their will towards their representatives. But the problem is, right now, our representatives are doing things that are outside of even what the will of their own people are asking for. If you talk about the feeling for public education in America, about 70 to 80% of Americans, if you look at some of the last AP studies or the last national studies from, you know, Stanford or Princeton or any of these, you know, major collegiate colleges, they're pro-education advocates. These are people that are constantly voting yes towards funding, taking care of, and ensuring the value of educational structures in America. But if you see that their public support is there, but then the people that are making the decisions for those structures are not listening to public will, and they are translating it into their own ridiculous policies because of their own personal belief structures or what they think is going to get them better elected because it's a hot topic. Not only are you screwing over the kids, and then you're taking away their voices or their perspectives that they can be celebrated with new literature, which, by the way, these books that are being banned, some of them were never available to you and I when we were kids.
Yeah.
These are books that could be so valuable for future generations of children. My two beautiful brown kids that I'm raising in my house now have a variety of literature available that can reflect not just their skin tone, but their mixed race background or their different livelihoods as they're growing up. Kids struggling in the past that never got to see that, it would be amazing to see a brown kid celebrated in a book. If you're looking at a lot of children's literature, if you're looking at a lot of these, do you know, crazy enough, what the number one story perspective was for kids from about 1970 through 1990?
No.
Can you take a guess, Frank?
1970 to 1990.
What would be the main character? What do you think? In most children's books.
My mind goes to something that's like, what age are you talking about?
So thinking about kids, let's say age 3 to age 6.
I mean, I would think it would be some kind of Disney related or some kind of cartoon related type of
animals.
Animals.
Because that takes away perspective from the different backgrounds of people.
Yes.
You can teach a lot of very good life lessons through the perspective of that. And that can become a multicultural approach to helping out children, which is what was done back in the day for parents that were in similar situations, such as I. But not being able to actually celebrate your individuality from your background, your actual perspective, that's a new concept. That's something that we've only seen since, you know, the mid-2000s onwards. And banning those books, or books that have families that are not from a quote-unquote traditional mother-father household. If you got two dads, why not have a book that talks about having two dads? If you've got two moms, why not have a book about having two moms? If you're being raised in a single-family household, then it's only a father or a mother, or a non-binary individual that is raising your kids. And from that, why not have a book talking about that? Because the kids want to know where they're living, how they're living, and seeing that reflected on the page, it's a powerful thing for kids. It's just, it blows my mind how so many people fight against it and treat it like this toxic subject because it can be used as a weapon.
Yeah.
When again, all you're doing is hurting kids in the process.
Yeah. Now, before I get to your Cubs experience, I got one more school-related thing, and that is, Are you at all worried about, does it cross your mind at all about possibly being involved in a school shooting on TV all the time? Is that something that you worry about as a teacher, or is it just not a Chicago thing? Or I'm just curious about school shooting, what you think about it?
So when it comes to preparedness and emergency responses, these are things that not a lot of school personnel or individuals really had to worry about for a very long time until, you know, the last, you know, 20, 30 years. I personally am not very afraid of that because I know the culture and the climate in our school building. I got to give major props to our school principal. We have a very unique environment and community here at Shute, where I teach, where the kids know that they're protected. They know that they're heard. They know that even when a bad situation can arise, they feel comfortable coming to the teachers. They feel comfortable to coming to the principal to let them know something's happening here, or somebody was mentioning this. And they don't feel like it's a snitching environment or something like that, because they know that we are all here to make sure that you are taken care of, that you're safe, that you're protected, that you're loved. the feeling when you come inside a building, and this is true for most schools in America, is once you walk through the door, you get a vibe. You kind of get a feel for like, how is it over here? Well, I'm not worried about things like that here at Shoot, because even in extreme situations, the kids pool together to take care of each other. And then the teachers are here to be very protective and to take care of the kids. And the administration is here to make sure that everybody feels safe, cared for, and loved. And as a school creates that type of an environment, even if the community around it can be a little more chaotic or a little more problematic with issues like that, if you have that environment there, the kids are going to be comfortable speaking up when they need to speak up. And then on top of that as well, from a security perspective, having security structures and having plans in place to know if this did happen, what do you do? If a lockdown needed to go into place, what are you doing? Practice and preparation with that is something that is going to make sure that school personnel and students know what safeguards they have in place. If something outside of our control was to pop up, what we can do to make sure that you're cared for here. So personally, again, not super concerned for myself or my safety, because I know I'm in a place that both students, staff, and admin are going to take care of each other and care for each other in those situations. Even if individuals are having a hard day, we have the resources to take care of them in those moments.
All right, let's talk about the good stuff now. Your first year at Wrigley, let's talk about how you heard, what year was it? How you heard about the Cubs, and what was your first year like? You know, the uniform, because everybody thinks you're a supervisor, but we all started somewhere. So tell us about the first year.
All right, so to give a throwback, I started with Wrigley in 2008. So this is my 16th season with the Cubs. In 2008, I was a high school junior needing a second job because my brother and I were helping split the mortgage from my parents because my dad was still currently trying to find a job because he had gotten laid off. And I was working, you know, about 30 hours a week already at an ice cream shop, and I needed to figure something else out. So I left the ice cream shop, started working at Barnes & Noble. Working there, I realized, this is great. I still need more cash. Doesn't pay enough. Minimum wage, be great to see it increase. That aside, though, one of the teachers that was one of my mentors over at my high school was actually friends with a former supervisor of ours, Gene Sims. And he knew that Gene was looking for more recruits for Wrigley for the upcoming season. And they were looking for high school age kids, college kids, to fill in some of these guest service roles that were open and available. And I always like to try new things. Truth be told, I'm not actually a huge baseball fan. 16 years in, I still love the Cubs. People think that I lie when I say that. I love the Cubs. They're my team. They're always my number one. But baseball is not my sport. It's not something that, you know, I feel tons of passion for. The reason that I've been there for 16 years is because I love the people that I work with. I love the community feelings. I also love just the millions of fans we get every year, getting to, you know, share stories and talk to them. So that those were the aspects of working at Wrigley that I was more interested in, is getting to see millions of new people every year, getting to hear the stories from some of the older staff. I was the type of person growing up where if I got to take a trip alone, I like to find, you know, somebody that was older that seemed a little more quiet and ask them about their life experiences. I remember taking the Amtrak to visit my family down in Tennessee and just, you know, occasionally popping up and just letting some people ride in the train that would want to spark a story. Usually they'd, you know, check on you if you were younger, you know, see how things are going. And then they just share their entire life with you because you've got 8 hours on a train, 9 hours on a train. There's not much else to do. Knowing that I could get that at Wrigley was an exciting idea. Plus getting to experience a part of Chicago that I didn't usually hang out in. Wrigleyville is not a place that I would usually go to. It would pretty much be the South Side Pilsen or like Mayfair Park, Jefferson Park. Like that, those were my areas of expertise. So I drove myself to Wrigley. Then I ended up doing a walk around with about a half an hour extra time that I had around the stadium, not knowing exactly where to enter because, you know, labeling back in the day wasn't exactly a strong suit of the Cubs. And I just remember seeing people getting off the train, getting to see how many just the everyday life and the city feel of it. It's not something that I got to be used to because I was so focused in on school, sports, work. It was just amazing. And then my first interview, I talked about baseball for 2 seconds. And then I got in a side conversation with the supervisor interviewing me at the time, Michael Kincaid. And we started talking about the Bears because football is a passion of mine. But then in talking with him years after that, he explained to me that he talked to me about a personal interest because he wanted to know how I engage socially. Do I have that ability to speak just about anything to anyone at any time? How engaging can I be? And I realized that was actually an interview tactic that he had used because he got to see that I was pretty personable. I could be very extroverted, and you need to be extroverted in this type of job. If you can't talk to different people, it's not that you can't do well at Wrigley, but you're going to have a much harder time because we are fan facing 95% of the time.
Now, what was the uniform?
So I, as a guest service associate that year, we were called ushers. We had this, you know, cotton, I believe it was like Gildan brand polos that were there. It was really heavy, very, very.
So you missed the vest. So you missed the red vest that I had.
Yeah, no, I was the, okay. They had gotten rid of the vests. I think it was 2 years before I started.
Okay.
And then we had these tan pants. I remember that they were just, I thought I could use them for school and how scratchy they were. I was not a fan of it,
yeah.
But you know, it was something. It was much better than a couple years after that. We ended up getting a sponsorship with Solo. So Solo Cups ended up doing a recycling initiative, which I am very green minded. I love recycling. I love the idea of eco-conservatism. However, the shirts that they made for us, which was made from recycled plastic cups, were not breathable. Yeah. They were not breathable. And that was when I had done my second season into then the next year being security. Those shirts were not a friend in the summertime, especially in the bleachers.
What color were those, security ones? What color were that?
The first year I was security, we were white. The crowd control shirts were white. And then when we got the Solo Cup shirts, we had then changed to red. So that was the first year that we actually switched to red since, I think, like the 80s.
Now, when you were security, what were some of your job? What were some of your assignments? I'm sure you were in the bleachers a couple of times, but what else did you do in security?
So I spent 4 years of security. So 2 years GSA, 4 years security. My first year for security, I was bag checking exclusively at the marquee gate. So gate F at the time when we were using ladders. And then I did a lot of work in the bleachers. So I was a bleacher security guard over on the wall, work on the wall for probably the other half of the season. Then the beginning of the next season, so my fourth year with the Cubs, I got moved around to some lead positions. That's when I started helping out with the radio. I started doing some lead in the terrace level. Then again, working in the bleachers a lot. But about a third of the way into the season, we were short one man on the field. And I actually got taken by an ex-manager of ours, Russell Johnson. And he had me work with Paco to work on the field. And basically from that day onwards, I was a field guard for the remainder of almost my last 3 years for security.
And so then what made you go from security to supervisor?
So I was interested at the time because I was talking with some of our other current supervisors, Eric Heilstead, Daniel Feingold, Corey Robinson. And we were all thinking about it because we knew that we had what it would take to become a supervisor. Again, I have a very protective mindset. I become a papa bear when it comes to the people that are in my life that I care about. And that includes every single associate that works at Wrigley Field. So I wanted to be in a position that I could start doing more to speak on behalf of the associates that we have. Also, if we're in an extreme situation or a crazy scenario, I want to know that I have the power to make a decision on that moment to help equitably take care of all parties involved, not only for the sake of safety and security, but also for the emotional support and comfort for the people around us. Something that I felt like we could have done a little better on at that time. And for those of you that know me out there in Wrigley, I'm pretty level-headed. I don't think anyone that's in our staff has ever really seen me ever lose my cool. And a lot of that goes with, you know,
I have once.
Well, do you remember?
At a meeting, though, it was at a meeting, we did feedback. It was there. That's like,
yeah, but I think you know the context of why I ended up because it was talking about things that were going to negatively impact the people that we work with,
yes,
the associates that work with us and for us.
Yeah.
And I will not let people get taken advantage of around me. I just won't do it. The only time you're going to see me turn into a pit bull is when I see somebody getting taken advantage of, children, especially that are in a dangerous situation. Or marginalized voices that aren't going to be heard. And, well, I'm going to take every ounce of white privilege I got, and I'm going to use that fiercely. All right, so back to why I ended up doing the interview process for it. It just felt like the right time. because I knew that I had the right temperament, the personality. And I think being as young as I was at that time too, I felt like I could take on the world and still survive the end of it, depending on, you know, even how rough a situation could get. It also helps that I have a mixed martial arts background. So I kind of use that in the interview process. Like, and if things got really bad, I can take care of myself in a situation so I could put myself in there strategically. I promise I'll never have to use it, because verbal judo techniques are something that I actually prize myself on. In Wrigley, I have talked more people off a ledge than I care to count. And a lot of that is, again, strong conversation, communication skills, something that I thought I brought to the table. So when I interviewed for it, I actually interviewed for the field supervisor spot, and security was my backup. I didn't even really think about taking over as guest services, but it was our assistant director at the time, Hannah Basinger, who realized that she saw potential in me to help out with guest services that I didn't even see in myself. So when she extended the offer for the guest service role, I was a little confused, because I'm like, I didn't even apply for guest service. I applied for, you know, field and then security. And looking back on it, I'm like, I couldn't think of a better fit for myself because of my focus on making sure that people are leaving happy. And it's, again, making sure that voices are heard, our staff is taken care of, and how many more people have touch points from that GSA role. I realized that was hand in glove. That was where I needed to go. And I'm glad that I did.
Okay. So I'm running out of time, but I'll let my guests ask me a question to end. So do you have a question for me?
In your experience with the Cubs over the past X amount of years, I'll let you leave that up to Vaidi. What would be your one key takeaway for anybody joining the organization to help them better balance their work-life situation?
That's a good one. To better balance. I feel like you can answer that better than me.
But this is me asking you, Frank.
I know. I'm trying to think, like, better balance the work life. The number one thing to me is, as a supervisor, we get cursed out all the time, or doing personality at the job, whatever. One, you have to make sure that you don't take things personally and don't take it home with you, because it would ruin your day, your week, your month, your year. So one, I think you gotta leave the job at home. You gotta leave it at Wrigley, because you'll go crazy trying to figure out, why are we doing this? Or why did he just say this? Or this person cursed me out. But also, you have to schedule, I tell it to Jordan all the time, you gotta schedule yourself on your schedule. Like, I have what we call Sunday, which is the day that I know I don't do anything, or I'm going out to the zoo with Jordan or whatever. But I also have Frank Day, which is a day for me. I don't take any calls. I'm not doing anything on work day. I'm not doing anything at all. But I think the big thing is to put yourself on your schedule. Because if you don't, and this is my own opinion, I don't want to put this out the Cubs, but people will take advantage of your free time and just, you know, have you work all the time. Your free time is your free time. It's not free time for somebody else to fill up and make you work. You got to take advantage of your free time. I didn't think that's my answer. What do you think?
I agree with you. I usually don't work Sundays because working and talking with my wife over the last several years, we wanted to make sure that we could have a consistent day that not only can we get stuff done, but my kids know I can count on dad being home. We can be doing things together. You got to learn when to say no. And that's something that a lot of people struggle with, because it's very easy to put yourself out there and to want to be helpful, to want to be able to, you know, add an extra pair of hands when we know that we're short-staffed. And as supervisors especially, that's a difficult thing. Sorry, that's a change in period, Bill. But knowing when to say no, or being able to take a step back and say, for my own sake, I know I'm going to need to take today, because I'm not going to be able to be as effective as I need to be if I'm here. So that's a life lesson that it took me years to figure out.
It was the pandemic. The pandemic let me see that I don't have to be at Big Hill. My life goes on. I can move on. If it wasn't for the pandemic, I would probably, you know, would have had that same mindset. But the pandemic had me realize I don't have to be here. And life will go on.
Yep. We still have our love, and nobody can ever take that away. My heart is still there, but my heart is also number one, primarily with my family. Yep. You know, nothing's going to take any spot over that in my life. And I need to make sure that I'm there for them first. So that means I'm not going to be able to be there every game. Yeah. I love our staff. I do. But kids come first.
Yes. All right.
Or my exceptionally beautiful wife that's sitting at my desk right now.
Can we see her real quick? Will she come by? You know what's funny about your wife? And I ran out of time. What's funny about your wife? Whenever your wife comes to a Far Office event, we always run to her first. Like, oh, hey, Kyle. But hey.
I still find that to be unfair. Yeah, come. Raina, come and say hi to everybody real quick.
You know your wife first whenever she comes.
They do. And this is what still blows my mind. Everyone in our friend circle would rather say hi to her than me first. She is the loved one. She, this beautiful angelic figure right above me, always gets first priority, which is garbage. I've put in 16 years.
Well, I'm just curious, though. What is it like working together and then having to go home together? Like, I'm just curious, what is it like?
She loves it so much, she's leaving me.
I am. This actually is my last year here. But it's been interesting. Okay. I feel like it's nice, especially because the kids get to see like what a functional, healthy relationship is. And a lot of them have expressed that we're like, I don't know, like their role models for, you know, what they would like in the future. And I think out of everything that has been, to me, like the best part is, especially for these girls that are so young. And so like just getting to work with my spouse has been like, it's been fun. It can get hard, but it's such a big school that we get to avoid each other if we need to.
We don't teach in the same room together ever. We have different schedules. So that's helpful. But what was nice this year, especially since when I said she's leaving me, I mean, she's leaving the school. She's not leaving me. We're still good. We're still here. We actually share the same lunch. So we get to spend fifth period every day together for lunchtime, whether we're just in the same room together or we actually watch something together, talk to each other. It's nice to have that. So it's something I'm going to miss next year.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. And thank you all for joining us. I'm going to take an identity and we'll catch you all in the next episode. And Kyle, I'll see you at Wrigley. Right now, you coming to Wrigley soon?
Probably.
Yes, I'll see you there then. All right. Thank you all very
much.
Bye.
Have a good one.
All right, Kyle. Thank you, Kyle.
You're welcome, Frank. And goodbye to everybody in Frank's fandom. I miss you all. I care about you all.
Hey guys, if you're hearing my voice here again, that means we've reached the end of the show. It's that time again for all the thank yous and special messages and disclaimers, you know, all the stuff you really tune in for each week. A big thank you yet again to all of our supporters who not only continue to tune into our show, but take the time to hit the like button, write reviews, and share our content on social media. It all really helps us grow our audience. Our Patreon page continues to thrive as well, as we're working not only on the podcast, but the Roku channel and the book club and on and on and on. If you'd like to be a part of that expanding Mistaken Identity experience, follow the link in our show notes to our Patreon page or go to patreon.com and search Mistaken Identity Podcast for all the ways you can sign up to access this multitude of additional content. Mistaken Identity is also now a part of the Unconfined Network, which is a home to many podcasts whose hosts have met inside the walls of Wrigley Field. Check out the network's other show offerings. Head to unconfinednetwork.com. That's all one word, unconfinednetwork.com, to view all of our shows and their catalogs. Shouts out to Frank Walker, Jesse Graham, and Jordan Burks for their continued efforts both in front and behind the scenes to keep Mistaken Identity rolling along every week. And of course, we can't leave without our disclaimer. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely our own, and we do not speak for or on behalf of the Chicago Cubs or any other organization. This is Joe Flaherty for the Mistaken Identity Podcast saying stay safe, and we'll catch you next time beyond the ballpark. We'll be right back.